Others are praying, others texting their final goodbyes. The mill aide is focused on the football. The special agent in charge and the three-man cat element are all focused on saving the president's life. In the cockpit, the pilot moves the helicopter into a steep climb, then indicates to the special agent in charge that the aircraft has reached the altitude required. The SAC signals to the lead operator on the cat element. The cat operator grabs the president by his harness and clips the commander-in-chief to his own body. The mill aide stands, the football secured to his chest. A second cat operator slides open the helicopter door. Wind rushes in. The president and the cat operator jump. The sack jumps. The mill aide jumps with the football. The two remaining cat operators jump. From inside the aircraft, the presidential advisors watch them go. The president, strapped to the cat operator in tandem, falls through the air. Rip, rip, rip. Each cat operator pulls his parachute's ripcord. The sack pulls his ripcord. The mill aide with the football pulls his ripcord. Six parachutes unfurl. Seconds pass. The parachutes floating to Earth as designed. There is a flash of nuclear light, followed by a fraction of a second of eerie and profound silence. Then, bam. 33 minutes, ground zero, the Pentagon. In the first fraction of a millisecond, a flash of light superheats the air to 180 million degrees Fahrenheit, incinerating people, places, and things, and absorbing a once bright, once powerful, once vibrant city center in a holocaust of fire and death. The fireball from this one megaton nuclear weapon that strikes the Pentagon is thousands of times more brilliant than the sun at noon. People from Baltimore, Maryland, to Quantico, Virginia, see this flash of light. Anyone staring directly at it is blinded by it. In this first millisecond, the fireball is a 440-foot diameter sphere. Over the next 10 seconds, it expands to 5,700 feet in diameter, more than 1 mile of pure fire, 19 football fields of fire, obliterating the nexus of American democracy. The edges of the fireball stretch all the way to the Lincoln Memorial to the north and into Crystal City to the south. Everything and everyone that existed in this space is incinerated. Nothing remains. No human, no squirrel, no ladybug. No plants, no animals, no cellular life. The air around the fireball's edges compresses into a steeply fronted blast wave. This dense wall of air pushes forward, mowing down everything and everyone in its path for 3 miles out in every direction. Accompanied by several hundred mile per hour winds, it is as if Washington, D.C., just got hit by an asteroid and its accompanying wave. In Ring 1, a 9-mile diameter ring, engineered structures change physical shape and most collapse. Piles of rubble left behind stand 30 or more feet high. The initial thermonuclear flash has set everything in the fireball's line of sight on fire. It melts lead, steel, titanium. It turns paved streets into molten asphalt. At the outer edges of Ring 1, rare survivors become trapped in liquefied roadways, catch fire, and melt. The X-ray light of the nuclear flash burns skin off people's bodies, leaving their extremities a shredded horror of bloody tendons and exposed bone. Wind rips the skin off people's faces and tears away limbs. Survivors die of shock, heart attack, blood loss. Errant power lines whip through the air, electrocuting people and setting new fires alight everywhere. As tens of seconds pass, the fireball rises 3 miles up into the air. Its ominous cloud cap turns the light of day into darkness. Some 1 to 2 million people are dead or dying, hundreds of thousands more now caught in the rubble and the flames. There will be virtually no survivors. The government's nuclear advisory panel has long warned of what will happen in the first ring around Ground Zero. There will be nothing recognizable remaining, only foundations and basements remaining. Never in the history of mankind have so many human beings been killed so fast. Not since a mountain-sized asteroid smashed into Earth 66 million years ago has so much global devastation been set in motion in a single strike. The die has been cast. The singular, haunting words from former STRATCOM commander General Robert Keeler come alive. The world could end in the next couple of hours. And now it is about to. 33 minutes. Serpukhov 15, Kaluga Oblast. In the forest 90 miles southwest of Moscow, in rural Kaluga Oblast, the Serpukhov 15 satellite control has picked up a signal. Red lights flash, alarms sound with shrill repetition. Attention, launch. An automated voice instructs the crew. An American ICBM launch has been detected. The instruction is followed by the first echelon command. Russian nomenclature indicating the highest level of nuclear alert. Serpukhov 15 is Russia's Western Command Center for incoming ICBM launch data. It is a component of the Russian Air and Space Forces, which itself is a separate branch of Russia's armed forces, subordinated directly to the General Staff, Pavel Podvig explains. The radars here receive data from Tundra space satellites, and it is the job of the Serpukhov 15 commander to relay that information up the chain of command. The Russian Ministry of Defense has had officers stationed at the Serpukhov 15 facility for more than 50 years. As in America, there have been terrifying false alarms. Once, in 1983, a lieutenant colonel named Stanislav Petrov was the commander in charge when satellite data indicated there were 5 American ICBMs on their way to strike Moscow with nuclear weapons. For reasons having to do with human intuition, Petrov became suspicious of that attack information. Years later, he told Washington Post reporter David Hoffman what he was thinking at the time. I had a funny feeling in my gut, Petrov said, asking himself, who starts a nuclear war against another superpower with just 5 ICBMs? In 1983, Petrov made the decision to interpret the early warning signal as a false alarm, he said, thereby not sending a report up the chain of command. For his well-placed skepticism, Lieutenant Colonel Stanislav Petrov famously became known as the man who saved the world from nuclear war. But in this moment of intense nuclear crisis, in this scenario, with the U.S. under nuclear attack and a slew of ICBMs having just launched from a missile field in Wyoming, the reaction of the present-day commander at Serpukhov 15 is different than Petrov's reaction was in 1983. It is not just that Tundra erroneously reports sunlight as hot rocket exhaust, or that it confuses clouds with missile plumes. Tundra misreports the number of things. Tundra can probably not accurately measure the number of ICBMs in a 50-Minuteman launch, Ted Postal maintains. It could look like 100 or more. The commander at Serpukhov 15 stares at the early warning data on the electronic screen in front of him. What are 50-Minuteman missiles heading over the North Pole? Tundra sees as more than 100 ICBMs. That is a motherload of nuclear warheads, enough for a preemptive decapitation strike against Moscow. The commander at Serpukhov 15 in this scenario does not have the same skepticism about intent that Lieutenant Colonel Petrov did some 40 years before. He picks up the phone and calls Moscow. "The Americans are attacking us with ICBMs," the commander says. 34 minutes, Hudson Yards, New York City. New York City lies roughly 2,500 miles east of Diablo Canyon in California and 200 miles northeast of Washington, D.C., as the crow flies. Not close enough to either location to yet feel the physical effects from the detonation of the nuclear bombs. But from a psychological standpoint, New York City, America's largest metropolis, erupts into panic and chaos. With news of nuclear attacks spreading across the world like wildfire, millions of New Yorkers fear their city to be a next target. At the cable news network studio in Hudson Yards, employees flee the building with an urgency not seen since World Trade Center employees tried desperately to escape the impending collapse of the Twin Towers on 9/11. A few journalists have stayed behind in the newsroom in this scenario. Those remaining at their posts scour social media sites still functioning, furiously searching for content to share with the world. Engineers in the tech room copied the Pointe Bouchon cattle rancher's video from social media, and it plays in a loop on screen. Like Jules Nadeau's 9/11 video of the first airplane crashing into the North Tower, this image is an origin point for war. No CNN reporter in D.C. answers his or her phone. Cell service is down. Northern Virginia has well over 60% of the world's data centers, America's first cyber chief, retired Brigadier General Gregory Tuhill tells us. No one from the White House press secretary's office can be reached. Messages for the CNN liaison at the Pentagon go directly to voicemail. Same with the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, Coast Guard, Space Force, Department of Homeland Security, and FBI. Before X buckled and crashed, cell phone videos were flooding social media platforms. Some of the visuals were screen grabbed here at CNN. But with one fact checker left in the building, authentication becomes an impossible job. How to discern images of reality from the horrifying AI movie clips flooding the internet? The fact checker stares at pictures of burned, blackened corpses, at people who do not look human or even real. As it was in Hiroshima and Nagasaki in August 1945, so it is in America now. People without faces, people without skin, naked people running, their clothes and bodies on fire, a man holding a dead child, a dead horse in the street, a teenager with a severed body part in hand. The anchor who has stayed here at Hudson Yards reads from a teleprompter, trying to keep his composure while beginning to process what is actually going on. Anchor, we understand that a nuclear bomb has apparently struck a nuclear power plant in California, 165 miles north of Los Angeles. His voice cracks. Anchor. And also, apparently, we just don't know for certain, just seconds or minutes ago, we don't have confirmation, a second nuclear bomb struck Washington, D.C. An emotional Walter Cronkite almost cried on live TV after President John F. Kennedy was murdered. After the Hindenburg Zeppelin exploded into flames, Herb Morrison screamed, "Oh, the humanity!" How to process this? The anchor looks down as a wireless emergency alert appears on his cell phone. He looks back up at the camera. Anchor, FEMA has issued this warning. He holds up his cell phone to the camera. It reads, U.S. under nuclear attack. Seek immediate shelter. This is not a drill. 35 minutes, Diablo Canyon, California. At the Diablo Canyon power plant, powerful updrafts suck radioactive dirt and debris up into the growing mushroom stem and cloud. Towering 30,000 feet high, this terrifying aberration is now visible from vista points up and down the California coast, including at Vandenberg Space Force Base, home to 4 of the 40 remaining interceptor missiles. Vandenberg Space Force Base is located roughly 35 miles to the southeast of where the Devil's Scenario is underway. The surrounding hills are on fire. Skyscraper-height flames devour forests, killing wildlife and subsuming everything in its path. Superheated winds from burning trees generate fire tornadoes, with hundreds of mile-an-hour winds knocking over trees and carrying car-sized burning debris into adjacent canyons, fueling new fires everywhere. For tens of thousands of Californians, abject panic takes hold as Diablo Canyon's emergency sirens, stretching out more than a dozen miles in all directions, begin screeching alarm. There is mayhem everywhere. Some 143,000 people reside in the 10-mile radius of Diablo Canyon's 12 protective action zones, all now trying to evacuate, all at once. From Pismo Beach to Los Osos, everyone is desperate to escape death by smoke, fire, and radiation poisoning. The outlook is grim. They are all trying to escape by way of a historic highway that is almost 100 years old. History lesson number 7, Proud Prophet War Game. In 1983, at a high point in nuclear stockpile insanity, when there were nearly 60,000 nuclear weapons ready to be launched, 35,804 in Russia, 23,305 in the U.S., President Reagan ordered a simulated war game codenamed Proud Prophet, to explore the outcome and effects of a nuclear war. The Proud Prophet war game was designed by a man named Thomas Schelling, a Cold War intellectual with economics degrees from Harvard and Berkeley. Schelling was a faculty member at the New England Complex Systems Institute, a think tank dedicated to the study of complex systems. Some complex systems exist in nature. Earth's global climate, the human brain, a living cell are all examples of complex systems. Others are made by humans and contingent upon machines, like the power grid, the internet, and the U.S. Department of Defense. Thomas Schelling's specialty was applying game theory to complex systems. He used mathematical models to discern and predict outcomes. He was taken very seriously. In 2005, when Schelling was in his 80s, he was awarded the Nobel Memorial Prize in Economic Sciences with Robert J. Aumann for having advanced our understanding of conflict and cooperation through game theory analysis. The power to hurt is bargaining power, Schelling famously wrote in his book, Arms and Influence. To exploit it is diplomacy, vicious diplomacy, but diplomacy. The goal of the classified Proud Profit war game was to demonstrate what happens when diplomacy fails, when deterrence fails. To demonstrate to the highest-ranking officers in the U.S. nuclear command and control system the various ways in which nuclear war could and would unfold after it began. Every day, for 2 weeks in 1983, more than 200 people gathered at the National War College in Washington, D.C. to play the game, cloistered away inside a secure location to prevent leaks. The National War College is located inside the National Defense University, which is located just across the river from the Pentagon. Each day to play the game, the Secretary of Defense would pick up a red phone and call the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to discuss various ideas in the different nuclear war scenarios put forth by Schelling. Schemes included everything from tactical nuclear strikes in a so-called limited nuclear war to massive decapitation event scenarios. There were exercises with NATO and without NATO nuclear forces getting involved. There were scenarios where the U.S. launched nuclear war preemptively, beginning with everyone at the Pentagon in a state of focused calm. There were exercises where nuclear war was launched in crisis mode, in full-on panic mode, with and without China entering the conflict, with and without the U.K. involved. Paul Bracken, a professor of political science at Yale, was one of the civilian individuals invited to participate in playing the classified nuclear war game. The results were horrifying, Bracken says. Over the course of 2 weeks, in every simulated scenario, and despite whatever particularly triggering event started the war game, nuclear war always ended the same way, with the same outcome. There is no way to win a nuclear war once it starts. There is no such thing as de-escalation. According to Proud Profit, regardless of how nuclear war begins, it ends with complete Armageddon-like destruction, with the U.S., Russia, and Europe totally destroyed, with the entire Northern Hemisphere uninhabitable from fallout, with the death of, at minimum, a 500 million people in the war's opening salvo alone, followed by the starvation and death of almost everyone who initially survived. The result was a catastrophe, Bracken recalls, a catastrophe that made all the wars of the past 500 years pale in comparison. 500 million human beings were killed in the initial exchanges. NATO was gone. So was a good part of Europe, the United States, and the Soviet Union. Major parts of the Northern Hemisphere would be uninhabitable for decades. Everyone left very upset. The results of Proud Profit remained unknown to the public for almost three decades, until 2012, when the war game was declassified, if you can call it declassification. Most pages were completely redacted. There was an upside. Proud Profit's declassification allowed people like Paul Bracken to discuss parts of it without violating the Espionage Act of 1917, even if in very general terms. From Bracken, we learn firsthand that military leaders at the time were wholly unprepared for the decisions they were going to have to make, from the initial spark of nuclear war to the last breath any of them would take. 14 years later, Vice President Al Gore asked Professor Bracken to lead a different kind of war game simulation, not a nuclear war game, but one involving a cyber attack on Wall Street. In the late 90s, VP Gore was worried that the newly popular internet was making America's banking system vulnerable to terrorist attack. His people asked me to set up a game, Bracken recalls of the Gore request, one that involved 75 military and civilian personnel, including bankers from Wall Street. The cloistered, classified room at the National War College was not available at the time. Someone from the financial firm Cantor Fitzgerald arranged for a banquet room at the World Trade Center, Bracken explains, in the top floor restaurant with its magnificent citywide view. A restaurant known as Windows on the World. For 3 days in 1997, the group engaged in a highly classified, simulated war game, a cyber terror attack. Their conclusion, drawn from the war game, was basic, Bracken contends. Move data storage away from Manhattan. The Wall Street firms accelerated the movement of data storage to New Jersey and Long Island. Cheaper, safer, great, except what we didn't figure out was the actual attack. Bracken laments. We didn't think of driving an airplane into the building where the game was being played. That is, flying a commercial airplane into the World Trade Center. 4 years later, 15 of the people who were playing that simulated war game were killed in the 9/11 terror attack at the World Trade Center when two commercial airliners were flown into the two tall towers there. The Windows on the World restaurant and both of the towers were reduced to rubble and ash. After nuclear war, much of 21st century humankind will be just the same. There one moment, then gone. 36 minutes, U.S. Strategic Command Headquarters, Nebraska. 36 minutes have passed in this scenario. The STRATCOM commander is out the door, running toward the Doomsday plane, officially called the E-4B Night Watch, a militarized, retrofitted Boeing 747 idling on the tarmac. The Doomsday plane is always ready for takeoff, ready 24/7, 365, to orchestrate a commander's airborne escape. This is because the Doomsday plane fights nuclear war from the air. It is springtime in Nebraska. The tarmac here is clear. No flooding, no hurricanes. The safe escape clock inside the underground bunker zeroed out minutes ago, but the STRATCOM commander had to get the universal unlock code from the President of the United States. And now he has. The amount of time it takes to exit the Global Operations Center, run across the tarmac, and sprint up the jet bridge stairs of the doomsday plane and into the Defense Department's war room in the sky is well rehearsed. I have a certain amount of minutes to get on that plane and for that plane to get off the ground and to a safe distance before a nuclear weapon goes off here, Stratcom Commander General Hyten told CNN in 2018. Inside the conference room on board the Doomsday plane, the commander straps himself in and rejoins the satellite comms with the nuclear command and control system commanders who remain alive. Still no word from the president. Still no word from the VP. The mill aide has the football. Stratcom knows this, and they know where the football is. Contained inside the satchel is a classified tracking system engineered to defeat EMP effects. The football is lying on the ground in a forested area in rural Boyds, Maryland. A quick reaction force has been dispatched from Camp David to locate and retrieve the football and hopefully the president. But the QRF helicopter is still in the air, and no one knows if the president is with the mill aide or if he and the cat operator he is with got separated by bomb blast and wind drift. The tracking systems on Marine One ceased transmission 3 minutes ago. All cell signals from the passengers on board and those who parachute jumped ceased transmitting when the bomb detonated over DC. Localized EMP zeroed out everything in the overpressure zone. The Secretary of Defense and the Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff were far enough out to remain flying. Now they are just minutes away from landing at Site R. The Vice Chairman is on the call with Stratcom via satellite phone. She waits for the commander to get oriented inside the war room on the Doomsday plane. The Doomsday plane got its name because it is the location from where the Stratcom commander, or whoever is acting as such, will execute emergency orders during nuclear war. Each jet is hardened against electromagnetic pulse, and with mesh over the windows to prevent against potential breakage by shockwave. The satellite-based communication system on the E-4B Nightwatch is designed to provide worldwide communications between senior military leaders and the joint force. The aircraft can fly in circles over the country for 24 or more hours at a time without refueling, dispatching nuclear launch codes to any leg of the triad, anywhere in the world. If its satellite comms go down nationally or globally, the Doomsday plane will use extremely high frequency EHF, and very low frequency, VLF-LF, links with other aircraft in its fleet. This includes the E-6 Mercury aircraft, officially called the Take Charge and Move Out platform, a Cold War-designed system that also functions as a last resort command center in the sky. Doomsday planes have equipment that allows the commander to launch remotely from the air all weapons in all three legs of the nuclear triad, submarines, bombers, and ICBMs, even after the system's individual launch control centers have lost the ability to do so from the ground. The Doomsday plane takes off from the tarmac here at Offutt Air Force Base at a maximum climb angle. The Stratcom commander is briefed on the strike against the Pentagon, given bomb damage assessment and death toll and casualty estimates. He is briefed on the time to target for the 50 Minuteman III ICBMs. He is briefed on the remaining time to launch for the Trident SLBMs. The commander is shown high-resolution images of Washington, D.C. These are digital composites being assembled in real time by advanced sensor systems onboard unmanned aircraft flying over Ground Zero around Washington, D.C. For decades, starting in the late 1940s, the Air Force practiced flying through nuclear mushroom clouds using decorated combat pilots like Colonel Hervey Stockman to develop tradecraft. Now, drones do this job. Unmanned vehicles controlled from a joint NSA-NRO facility, not in D.C., an installation so highly classified, sharing its location would be a violation of the Espionage Act. The sensor systems on board include the DARPA-conceived autonomous real-time ground ubiquitous surveillance infrared system, designed to provide battlefield commanders with situational awareness on the ground. In 2013, the Argus infrared system could identify a person wearing a wristwatch from over 2 miles away, its name an homage to the ancient Greek beast Argus Panoptes, an all-seeing monster with 100 eyes. The STRATCOM commander stares at ghastly images of where the mighty U.S. Pentagon once stood. The visuals are devastating. At the dawn of the nuclear age, the Joint Chiefs of Staff were forewarned that nuclear bombs were a threat to mankind and to civilization, that if used against cities, they could depopulate vast areas of the Earth's surface. And now, the STRATCOM commander is one of the first Americans to see this prediction come true. He sees it from above with his own eyes. 37 minutes, undisclosed location, Pacific Ocean. Thousands of miles from Washington, D.C., in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, in an undisclosed location known only to its commander and crew, sirens on the USS Nebraska blare. All 155 submariners on board this vessel remain intensely focused on one thing and one thing only: nuclear launch. The USS Nebraska is a nuclear-powered, nuclear-armed submarine, singularly capable of unleashing 20 times more destruction than all the explosives used in World War II, including both atomic bombs dropped on Japan. Like all Ohio-class submarines, the Nebraska is silent, undetectable, and always ready for launch. In this moment, launch is seconds away. We have the power to destroy an adversary's military, infrastructure, and everything in between, submariner Mark Levin told listeners in a Defense Department podcast. A survivable system for carrying out a retaliatory nuclear attack. Survivable means the submarine survives. The crew on the USS Nebraska is highly skilled and uniquely trained. They are accustomed to traveling deep underwater for 70 days at a time. No texts, no emails, no radio contact, no radar signature. U.S. Ohio-class submariners pride themselves as being the ultimate nuclear deterrent. Only an insane person would want to be on the receiving end of its wrath. When the crew gets the order to launch nuclear weapons, it follows those orders precisely as rehearsed. The launch order from the president was authenticated and decoded by two junior officers. This string of coded data includes information about plan of action and timing of action, about which targets to strike, the precise coordinates involved, and when. The action begins. Of all the complex, multi-step protocols and procedures in the U.S. nuclear command and control, the firing of Trident nuclear missiles is designed to be simple and fast. The crew moves the 18,750-ton submarine into position to its subsurface launch depth of around 150 feet. The commanding officer, the executive officer, and two junior officers each individually authenticate the president's order one last time. The captain and his executive officer open the onboard double safe. The two individuals retrieve two items from inside the safe: a sealed authenticator system card and a fire control key are each removed. The key is inserted into its requisite slot, then turned. The missiles are armed and ready to fire. There are 20 active missile tubes on each Ohio-class nuclear submarine. Each tube contains a Trident II D5 missile. 8 of the 20 missiles will fire. Each of the 8 missiles is armed with 4 separate nuclear warheads in its nose cone. Each warhead carries a 455-kiloton nuclear bomb. The commanding officer authorizes the launch of the 8 Trident missiles. The weapons officer pulls the trigger that launches the first missile. An explosive charge flash vaporizes a tank of water at the base of the missile tube. The pressure of the expanding gas drives the missile out of the submarine through a diaphragm at the top of the launch tube, jettisoning the rocket out of the tube, out of the body of the submersible, and away from the submarine with enough momentum to reach the surface. A little more than 1 second after launch, the first Trident missile breaches the waterline. As it clears the surface of the Pacific, its first stage rocket motor ignites. Rising up into the air, boost phase begins. 15 seconds pass. The second Trident missile emerges from its tube, and the next one comes 15 seconds after that. The fittingly simple order goes like this: Missile 1, Missile 2, Missile 3, Missile 4, Missile 5, Missile 6, Missile 7, Missile 8. 8 missiles, each carrying 4 455-kiloton nuclear warheads, for a total of 32 warheads that will soon destroy multiple targets across North Korea. The first stage on each rocket will burn for 65 seconds, followed by another 14 minutes of travel time to target. As is the case with an ICBM, an SLBM cannot be recalled. What is done is done. 37 minutes, 30 seconds. Joint Operations Intelligence Center, Raven Rock Mountain Complex, Pennsylvania. Deep inside the belly of the Raven Rock Mountain Complex, officers working nuclear support operations in DISA's Joint Operations Intelligence Center fire off emergency action commands. FPCON Delta, Force Protection Condition 1, the highest alert level for an attack against a military installation, is now officially in effect. This is enacted separately from DEFCON 1, which presumes an attack on the civilian population. Department of Homeland Security instructs Customs and Border Protection, the Department of Transportation, and the Coast Guard to close all U.S. borders. The Federal Aviation Administration issues SCATANA, the plan for the security control of air traffic and air navigation aids under emergency conditions, grounding all aircraft. At all military installations around the nation, garrison gates close. Base security forces initiate 100% ID card check protocols. Rapid base containment by local military and civilian forces begins. At U.S. military installations around the world, geographic combatant commanders enforce FPCON Delta measures in a futile attempt to secure and protect their areas of responsibility from attack. Futile because nuclear attacks are impossible to defend against. Still, lockdown has begun around the world. America is at nuclear war with North Korea. 38 minutes, ground zero, ring one and ring two. In Washington, D.C., ring one is a holocaust. Ring one is that 9-mile diameter area around ground zero where engineered structures have changed shape and collapsed. Casualties near 100%. Everyone is dead or dying. Buildings that once stood upright herein. The White House, the Capitol, the Supreme Court, the U.S. Departments of Justice and State, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the U.S. Treasury, the Library of Congress, the National Archives, the Metropolitan Police Department, the U.S. Departments of Agriculture, Education, Energy, Health and Human Services, the National Academy of Sciences, the American Red Cross, Constitution Hall, to name but a few. They have been obliterated, shattered, blown apart, cracked open, knocked down, and set alight. All of the human beings who were standing, sitting, walking, waiting, or working in each and every one of these buildings just a few minutes ago are no more. The iconic structures built of chiseled granite and marble, of steel and stone, with Parthenon-styled columns and neoclassical facades. If they once seemed indomitable, they are now just piles of rubble and debris, wreckage of war, shavings and fragments of things that once were. Consider the tiny sliver of land that was the National Mall, the long, grassy park known as America's Front Yard, a park visited by over 25 million people each year, a once popular place for music concerts and festivals, for picnics and protests, for joggers and tourists and newlyweds. It represents an infinitesimal amount of what is now gone. 5 minutes ago, this landscaped park was lined with history museums and curious visitors. Now, everything in all the Smithsonian museums, the dinosaur fossils, the botany and book collections, the paintings in the National Portrait Gallery, Muhammad Ali's robe, all the people gazing curiously at these collections, they were there 1 minute and a second later violently transformed into millimeter-sized pieces of ash. Ground Zero's Ring 2 is ablaze. Ring 2 is the 15-mile diameter ring, an area where a vast majority of those not already dead are in the process of dying from third-degree burns. The nuclear bomb's 180 million degree Fahrenheit flash of X-ray light has ignited a mass fire that now begins to consume everything in this ring and beyond. Millions of flammable items in Ring 2 have been set alight all at once, like millions of matches dropped in dry grass. Ignition is complicated, Dr. Glenn McDuff tells us. Los Alamos scientists have spent decades calculating ignition thresholds for natural and man-made items in the vicinity of a nuclear detonation. Pine needles and black rubber can spontaneously ignite 7.5 miles from the center point of a 1 megaton detonation, as does most car upholstery, whereas plastics are more likely to emit jets of flame. These mini torches of fire start new fires, which start new fires. Buildings not yet ablaze soon will be. This includes most of everything south to Alexandria, west to Falls Church, north to Chevy Chase, east to Capitol Heights, and all the neighborhoods in between. Just 5 minutes have passed since a nuclear bomb hit the Pentagon. The fire that is burning down Ring 2 will kill more people than the bomb itself. Stanford scholar emeritus Lynn Eden explains. The energy released by this mass fire would be 15 to 50 times greater than the energy produced by the original nuclear detonation, with winds powerful enough to uproot trees 3 feet in diameter and suck people from outside the fire into it. Human beings will be physically drawn up from one space into another, as if caught inside some monstrous, colossal vacuum or pump. Ted Postal describes how this happens from a physicist's point of view. A counterintuitive process begins, he says. The fireball will rise buoyantly to an altitude of maybe 5 miles before it stabilizes. During the process of rising, it creates gigantic afterwinds on the ground of roughly 200 to 300 miles per hour internal, just from the sucking action of this rising fireball that moves inward rather than outward. As this whipping, whirling cyclone of fire grows more vicious by the second, it begins to create its own weather as it burns out of control. In the next few hours, it will consume all of Greater Washington, D.C., and the suburbs beyond. It will destroy everything and everyone in the city until there is nothing left to burn. Meanwhile, the bomb's electromagnetic pulse has knocked out electricity. Without power, there are no water pumps. Without water, there is no way for humans to put out these raging fires. No emergency crews will arrive. Lethal-level radiation after a nuclear explosion means first responders wait 24 to 72 hours before going into regions at the outer edges of the vast fire zone. In the time that passes, everything in a 100 square mile or more radius around Ground Zero will burn. FEMA's own headquarters, located 2.1 miles northeast of the Pentagon at 500 C Street Southwest, has been flattened. FEMA's 10 regional offices around the country are already overwhelmed. Across the landscape of Ring 2, parts of buildings that survived the initial blast collapse, adding more fuel to the fires. Gas lines explode. Tankers carrying hazardous materials explode. Chemical factories explode, setting new fires. In pockets of places not yet physically ablaze, superheated winds of hurricane force bring air temperatures in excess of 1,220 degrees Fahrenheit, melting lead and aluminum. In the outer edges of Ring 2, survivors in subway tunnels and basement bunkers gasp for air. If the carbon monoxide hasn't already killed them, it will soon. In secret tunnels beneath the Capitol building and the White House, statesmen and staffers bake to death as if inside a broiler oven. Like firefighters caught in a raging wildfire, there is no way to escape, no way to survive. In Washington, D.C., all is lost. 38 minutes. Raven Rock Mountain Complex, Pennsylvania. It is 3:41 p.m. local time when the Osprey touches down on the helipad near Site R's West Gate. The nuclear command post is on lockdown. Soldiers armed with assault rifles man the guard towers, eyeing the tree line for possible breach or attack. With FPCON Delta in effect, all area personnel have been called to arms. Everyone at the Raven Rock Mountain Complex in the Blue Ridge Mountains is on the highest level of threat alert. The Secretary of Defense and Vice Chairman will be taken in through Portal B, a double-doored entrance shaft near the fortified East Vent. But getting out of the helicopter in this scenario is taking longer than it should. The Secretary of Defense has been blinded by thermonuclear flash. Because he cannot see, he cannot walk without someone guiding him. The visual impairment is likely non-permanent. Nuclear flash can temporarily blind people and animals who happen to be looking in the direction of a nuclear explosion when it occurs, even if they are as far as 50 miles away. The Secretary of Defense was looking out the helicopter window in the direction of the Pentagon when the bomb detonated. The transparencies on the Osprey are among the most sophisticated in the world, but they'd never been put through an actual nuclear bomb test. The SecDef knew better than to look in the direction of the bomb when it exploded, but like a moth drawn to a flame, he had to see deterrence fail with his own two eyes. He had to see it to believe it, and now he's blind. There is still no word from the president. This is not good. The vice president, the Speaker of the House, the president pro tempore of the Senate, the Secretary of State, and the Secretary of the Treasury have all been unlocatable since the bomb struck the Pentagon minutes ago. With these five individuals now presumed dead, the Secretary of Defense is the next in line for presidential succession. Someone needs to be sworn in as Commander-in-Chief, and fast. Now is not the time for the nation to be without a leader. But a suddenly blind Secretary of Defense, addressing a terrified nation to announce he's the acting president in an unfolding nuclear catastrophe, is far from ideal. Aides help the sightless SecDef disembark from the helicopter. The group passes through security and into Portal B, into an elevator that takes them down 650 feet. Into a series of cavernous tunnels and bunkers and office-style rooms. Raven Rock was built to hold 3,000 people inside its original 265,000 square feet of space, including leaders of the military branches and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. But a nuclear strike against D.C. is a decapitation event. Only a handful of people got out of Washington before the bomb hit. The Marine helicopters carrying the president's executive staff have also been radio silent since detonation. The Secretary of Defense and the Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff discuss the most pressing issue at hand. Vice Chairman to SecDef. We need to get Moscow on the line. Each has been trying to reach their Russian counterpart without success. They are in agreement that nothing is more imperative than to get the Russian president on the phone. As the pair moves through the underground command center, Dysa continues to work to connect with the Kremlin. Aides scramble to locate a Bible or any kind of book,